Radio Hall of Fame. The Radio Hall of Fame is presented during the full hour ahead by Philco Corporation, makers today of radar and electronic battle equipment for the fighting forces of the United Nations. Makers tomorrow of equipment for good living in a free world united by victory. Each week, the editors and correspondents of Variety report and select for the Philco program the hits of the show world from all fields of entertainment. And now, may I present our master of ceremonies, the distinguished composer, author, and commentator, Deems Taylor.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This week, the editors of Variety recommend for your pleasure and Philco delights to honor in your name,
from the theater and motion pictures, Paul Muni. From vaudeville and nightclubs, Sophie Tucker. From vaudeville and radio, Tom Howard and George Shelton. From motion pictures and radio, Richard Hyden. From nightclubs and the recording studios, Robert Crumb.
And now, marking his customary grand entrance to conduct the Philco Radio Hall of Fame Orchestra and Chorus, comes Paul Whiteman.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Whiteman speaking. Our pristine offering today is a deft transliteration of a lyric gem that is at present in high esteem among those who woo the Latin American youth.
Or to put it more bluntly, today's opening number is the current Latin American favorite, Amor, Amor.
Thank you.
1939, the great Beatrice Lilly brought to New York a review entitled Set to Music. In the cast was a young actor named Richard Haydn, whom Variety singled out for particular attention as being the only man in the world who can imitate fish. Mr. Haydn also happened to be a skilled comedian, as the movies soon discovered, and as you also know if you've seen him in such pictures as Ball of Fire, Charlie's Aunt, and most recently in No Time for Love with Claudette Colbert. And so, in recognition of this record of achievement, Philco welcomes to the Radio Hall of Fame Richard Haydn. Dick, we haven't seen much of you lately.
Well, Dean, for the past year I've been entertaining troops in North Africa.
Did you cover much ground?
We did about 25,000 miles altogether, entertaining upwards of 30,000 men a week.
Oh, by the way, did you do the professor act?
Oh, yes, rather.
What's the professor you're talking about today?
Well, Deans, I thought fish mimicry. Would you mind introducing him?
Not at all.
Right.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present one of the strangest phenomena of the 20th century. The only living fish mimic, Professor Richard Haydn.
How do you do? I stand before this magical microphone... The only natural fish mimic in the entire universe. There are, of course, other mimics, but none so completely natural as myself. I am married, having a wife, and this is no time for tittering, and two children. And in passing, it is interesting to note that they cannot imitate fish at all. In appearance, I am rising 63. Of medium stature, having apricot-coloured hair, a pointed face, glasses, and a fawn moustache. And looking at me, it is difficult to imagine why I have been endowed with this great gift. By great gift, I of course refer to my powers of fish mimicry, and not to my fawn moustache. In connection with my fawn moustache, it is interesting to note that the clarity of my upper register when imitating the common skate is entirely due to this appendage. After my first fish mimicking recital, a startled scientific world subjected my great gift to a searching examination, and it was discovered that the lifelike reproduction was caused by my fawn moustache, which, falling as it does, I must insist upon a deathly ash, which, falling as it does, outwards and downwards, to the extent of 1 1/8 inches, forms a sort of natural baffle board. I did not discover my great gift until, as you see, late in years, and the method of its discovery is in itself highly entertaining. Some 5 years ago, I was out shopping when an errand boy dropped a package upon my foot. As is natural under such circumstances, I cried out, inadvertently emitting the call of the goby or sea squirt. And a well-known fishmonger who was passing on a... Now, look, I don't want to have to get ugly. Who was passing on a bus, got off and said to me, "That voice is a gold mine." My reply was, "What do you mean?" And over a cup of tea, he told me. Since that day, my life has been one long extravaganza. When I decided to allow the world to share my great gift by going on the stage, my friends all said, "You must be mad. That life will kill you." My reply was, "Well, we will see." Since making my fish mimicking debut, I have been classed by those in the know with such uncanny phenomena as the Colossus at Rhodes, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and the Changing of the Guard. I will now give you... You'll do yourself an injury. I will now give you a demonstration of one of my most superhuman feats. I will imitate the call of the red-bellied gudgeon, or a blushing fish. This call is so high in the scale as to be completely inaudible to the human eardrum. Dogs can hear it, however, as their eardrums are highly sensitive. And it is also audible to a certain lady friend of mine, who shall be nameless, called Mrs. Phelps, who lives at Flushing and who has been endowed, through some caprice of Mother Nature, with the eardrums of an elk hound. I will now give the call of the red-bellied gudgeon or blushing fish, and although you will hear practically nothing, I advise you to watch the expression on your dog's faces should you chance to have him or her listening in. Now, will you please listen carefully and watch your dog's faces? Are you ready? Are your dogs ready? They're amazing, is it not?
A few weeks ago, an event of great significance to the development of television took place. The first chain television program was put on the air over a network that connected New York City with Schenectady and Philadelphia. Thus, the pioneer step was taken, which will enable you someday to witness events in your home that take place hundreds, yes, thousands of miles away by television. It is important to understand in this connection that television waves, unlike radio waves, travel in straight lines. They shoot off the earth at the distance of the horizon. Thus, to receive a television program hundreds of miles away, a system of relay stations must be established that capture and rebroadcast these television waves before they leave the earth. Since 1932, Philco has pioneered in establishing the technique of television chains through the work of its television station in Philadelphia. And the first network program recently put on the air was seen in Philadelphia over a television link that was developed, designed, and built by Philco engineers. Thus, as another milestone of progress is passed, Philco is in the forefront of the developments that will make television a nationwide service for the homes of America.
At the age of 3, Robert Crumb was playing the piano. At 9, he was studying at the Pittsburgh Musical Institute. After that, more studies under Maupin at the Paris Conservatory. Returning to America, he went through the years of struggle that seemed to be the lot of so many young musicians, eventually coming into his own with a half-year's engagement at the College Inn in Chicago. At present, he's featured at the Blue Angel in New York, where Variety noted that he brings a concert technique to jazz and boogie-woogie. Wherefore, Philco welcomes him today, playing a set of impromptu variations on a number of things. Robert Crumb. As a rule, motion picture stars are content to play themselves, regardless of what characters they're supposed to be playing. There is, however, at least one screen actor who's become a famous star by not playing himself, and his name is Paul Muni. Look back over his best-known pictures, and in every one you'll find him looking different and being different. In his latest picture, The Song That Lived Forever, soon to be released by Columbia, he appears as the music teacher of Frédéric Chopin. But it isn't only his appearance that varies. There's a quality of authority and a mastery of characterization in his acting that go much deeper than makeup. And so Philco takes great pride in welcoming to the Radio Hall of Fame one of the finest actors on the screen. With him is Grace Coppin, both playing in Milton Geiger's No Common Clay, with music by Paul Creston. Enter Paul Muni.
Behind his desk in a great metropolitan hospital sits Dr. Stanley Vickery, the new chief of surgical staff. Just now, Dr. Vickery is deeply, solemnly preoccupied, lonely. There are stern lines about his mouth. His eyes are shadowy with doubt. Then there's a quick knock at the door. At once, dignity and hard discipline return to the harassed eyes. The doctor's voice is firm.
Yes. Come in, please.
Good morning, Dr.
Vickery. Stanley Vickery.
Of course. I'm so sorry. Dr. Shackleton said you wanted to see me.
Yes. I've been interviewing the staff, getting acquainted, so to speak. Dr. Shackleton and I were discussing some rather particular aspects of neurosurgery. A special case that came up to my attention, and your name came up.
Well, actually, I haven't done much brain surgery. I prefer abdominal and thoracic surgery.
Your record says you've done a good deal of brain work.
I prefer the other thing.
It's my feeling that our surgical staff is a little out of balance. You mustn't think I favor neurosurgery simply because it happens to be my specialty.
No, doctor.
And I hope you won't think me arbitrary in asking that you work with me for a while. Do you mind?
Just as you say, doctor.
Good. Let me add this. You may find me difficult at times. If so, please try to bear with me. What I do has its purposes. But never do I deliberately intend to hurt or to wound or to humiliate. Remember that.
Why, yes, doctor.
Thank you. Surgery 4-H tomorrow morning at 8. Good day. Nurse, ready with my gown and gloves, please.
Dr. Vickery.
Oh, yes, Dr. Travis, just on time. Nurse!
One moment, doctor, please.
Yes.
Dr. Cromson says he is assisting you today. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. I want you to stand by and observe everything I do.
Stand by?
And observe.
But I'm a surgeon in my own right, and a good one, if you please. I'll not be relegated to the status of a sponge nurse.
Well, that's putting it pretty harshly.
I am not a mere student, Dr. Vickery. I won't submit to this.
Oh. Is this your resignation, doctor?
I see. You know how much this position means to me, don't you? You know how hard it is for a woman to get where I've finally gotten, especially in surgery. I can't resign. I'm a woman.
And I suppose I'm taking unfair advantage of your disadvantage.
What do you think, doctor?
I think that you've arrived at a diagnosis before all the symptoms have appeared. That may take some time, doctor. Until then, nurse, a gown and gloves for Dr. Travis, please.
But good heavens, Vickery, can't you go a little easier on the girl?
Has Dr. Travis been complaining, Shackleton?
No, but we all can see how you've been treating her. Don't you like her?
Do I have to like her? She's a surgeon.
And a good one. The fact that she's a woman has prejudice.
Nothing to do with it.
All right, all right.
And we'll say no more about it.
All right, I'm happy.
Congratulations. Now, will you be good enough to send in Dr. Travis? I want to speak to her.
I'm sorry Dr. Shackleton raised the issue. I've no complaints, none at all.
If you have any mental reservations on that score, remember that for the past several months, you've been assisting me.
I know, but you can't blame me for recalling that I used to have assistants helping me. However, I respect your authority and I accept it. But I also understand your motives in what you've been doing.
Oh, you do.
Ever since you came here, you stood in my way, prevented my advancement. You've done everything to thwart me and hold me back. You've reduced me to the role of an assistant and kept me there, obscure, anonymous.
Then perhaps you should have been a celebrated cocktail girl.
Dr. Vickery.
A notorious divorcee, a headline hunter, not a surgeon.
You've no right to speak to me
you
like that.
You spoke of obscurity, your anonymity. Do you want publicity?
Oh, you wouldn't put such an interpretation on what I said. I didn't mean that at all.
A woman who prides herself on her science should be more exact in her speech.
And Dr. Shackleton assured me that you had no prejudice against women in medicine. Not much.
You may go, Dr. Travis.
Very well, Doctor. Good morning.
What else am I to do?
What am I to do?
Shackleton, this is Dr. Vickery. Can you tell me where Dr. Travis lives?
At 2 o'clock in the morning.
Just answer my question.
Look in the telephone directory.
No good. She's moved recently.
Oh, well, wait a minute. I'll see if I have her someplace. Hold on.
Yes? Oh, Dr. Vickery.
I hope you'll forgive me. Fantastic hour to be calling on people.
It's all right. I was up reading. I usually am. Come in.
Thank you. No, I just happened to be walking by.
At this fantastic hour, and I quote...
Yes, yes, I happen to be walking. I like walking. I walk a great deal at night. And passing by, I felt I should drop in and try to make some amends for my behavior today. Please forgive me. I plead nervousness and overwork.
I understand, Doctor.
Believe me, I meant no hurt to you. Most of all, put out of your mind any thought that I consider you less than my equal.
Well, now, that's another matter, Doctor.
Why?
I know that you'll never allow me to be your equal professionally.
I came here tonight to ask for your indulgence, your patience.
What do you expect after everything I've endured?
At least the compliment of your belief in my sincerity.
If you're going to quarrel, come inside.
No. If you question my sincerity...
Who is to blame for that?
Be good enough to see me in my office tomorrow morning, Dr. Travis.
A rebuke?
No, Doctor. A challenge. Good night.
Asked me to come down this morning, Doctor.
Yes, please sit down.
May I stand?
As you like. What's your operating schedule for tomorrow?
My own, you mean? Just 3 routine appendectomies.
I believe I told you I dislike that word routine in discussing operative procedure. It implies a too casual approach to surgery, which is never a casual thing. However, that's beside the point just now. Dr. McCauley will handle your schedule tomorrow.
I'm not operating tomorrow.
I didn't say that, Doctor. You will not perform your scheduled operations. I have another assignment for you.
Oh.
The essential facts are on this case card. I have also on my desk a statement signed by the patient, releasing the operating surgeon from any blame, whatever happens. I thought it desirable.
A signed release? Why should that be necessary?
I said desirable, Doctor.
May I look at the card?
By all means.
No. This isn't fair.
Indeed? Why not?
Because it's an outrage to ask any surgeon to risk his reputation in a case as hopeless as this.
I'm sorry you feel that way about it, because I'm going to have to insist upon your attempting the operation.
Then I shall have to refuse. This poor man, whoever he is going to die, and you know it. And you'd like him to die under my knife. Pretty clumsy bait, Doctor, and I won't take it.
Believe me, I'm more experienced than you are. And I know that this man need not die.
Then why don't you operate? I'll tell you why. You've always resented me because I had the audacity to become a successful surgeon. I, a woman. It was something not to be countenanced, unthinkable. What if I should become too good, too important? What if I should even usurp the reputation of the great Dr. Stanley Vickery? So you reduced me to the level of a not very bright intern and kept me there. And now you want to destroy me entirely. It won't work, Doctor.
I've told you that our art is very long and our time very short. I never thought to thwart your career. Far from it. Far from it, I say. I've never disapproved of women in surgery.
No.
Rather, I have always felt that the technique, the mere craft and carpentry of surgery is a thing relatively easy to learn, but there is a philosophy as well as a technique to our particular trade. A philosophy that embraces such intangibles as humanity, love, pity, infinite gentleness of spirit as well as of hand. And these are fragile things which few men own, which cannot be learned, yet which are given freely to woman. I saw them in you, along with great technical skill and understanding. I saw my chance to create something.
Dr. Vickery.
Wait. From the very beginning, I believed in you. You were a fine surgeon, and you were a woman. Together, the highest expression of civilization and humanity that I know of. Here, I thought, was good mobile plastic stuff. Uncommon clay indeed, with which to mold, who knows, a masterpiece.
In your own splendid image. No. Oh, no. No one could have such appalling vanity. Not even you.
Call it that if you like.
What on earth else?
I told you the truth as I know it. I built hoping always that I was building better than I knew.
You thought I was trying to thrust you into obscurity. I only meant to teach you all I knew, quickly as I could. And having brought my unwilling pupil to maturity, she trembles at the thought of failure. Well, I suppose you'll be wanting to consider your resignation effective immediately.
Oh, I see. That again.
Let me repeat, the patient need not die.
All right. You win again. When do you want me in surgery?
8 a.m. sharp.
Thank you. I'll operate on one condition.
Yes?
I want you there. I deserve the advantage of your presence.
I'll be there.
Thank you. I also deserve that division of responsibility.
Now, shall we discuss the case in some detail? May I offer a few suggestions, Doctor?
Please do.
The patient is in good physical condition. His outlook is good. He has the utmost faith in his surgeons.
Go on.
Naturally, he exhibits pronounced nervous symptoms. I recommend that the patient be given one capsule of Nembutal at once and another before being wheeled into the operating room. That will allay his nervous apprehension and allow smoother induction of anesthesia. One moment, please. Miss Bishop.
Yes, Dr. Vickery?
Will you bring in the Nembutal, please? They're on your desk, I believe.
Yes, Doctor. Right away.
You'll be wanting them, and the dispensary is slow in sending them up sometime.
It's very thoughtful of you, Doctor.
Here they are, Doctor. Nembutal grains 1 1/2.
Thank you. There we are. I'm a bit unnerved. I'd get to have one of these myself. Excuse me.
A little absurd when you stop to think about it.
Really?
It was my impression that they were for the patient.
Precisely. Precisely.
Dr. Vickery, what do you mean?
That the patient is to receive another capsule in the morning, that I shall be on hand promptly at the appointed time, and that, needless to say, I shall not be able to render the least assistance.
Why didn't you tell me it was you?
I never could tell you.
But you
have known the responsibility for which I intended you, it might have been too much.
You could have told me now, today.
And let your pity make you undertake something within your heart, but beyond your powers? No.
But am I ready? Am I?
You chose to operate, not in pity, but in cold reasoning anger. Within yourself, you know that you're ready. So do I. This is my faith in you. This is my belief in what you are. My belief in what I've wrought through all these months from most uncommon clay. We have a rendezvous then tomorrow morning at 8.
Yes. Until tomorrow, goodbye, Dr. Vickery.
Until tomorrow, goodbye, Janet.
Thank you.
1799, a French officer named Boussal discovered near the town of Rosetta in Egypt a stone slab bearing an inscription in two Egyptian dialects and Greek, thus making it possible for the first time to decipher all the writings of the ancient Egyptians. It must have been a great thrill when the meaning of the first line became clear. And by the way, Mr. Riggs, what was that first line?
This is the Blue Network.
Act two of the Radio Hall of Fame now opens to bring us a hardy perennial. Songs may come and songs may go, but here's one that's always with us. Paul Whiteman and the Hall of Fame Orchestra and Chorus offer Theodore Weingand's fantasy on the Russian gypsy song, Dark Eyes.
Thank you.
Write often to your man overseas, and when you do, use V-mail. It's the fastest, safest way to send your letter, because V-mail gets preferred handling by the Army and Navy. It is sent overseas by air, and delivery is guaranteed. V-mail arrives in a sealed envelope and is just as private as any other kind of personal mail. Our soldiers and sailors want you to use V-mail because it saves precious cargo space for their food, ammunition, and equipment. Get the habit. Use V-mail. You can buy the forms at any stationery, drug, or department store.
If you're interested in radio quiz programs, you've probably tuned in to a particularly zany little offering known as It Pays to Be Ignorant, with Tom Howard and George Shelton, two gentlemen who have a genius for getting off the subject. The two met first in vaudeville, and there has been no happier partnership since Romeo met Juliet. And so, for the happiness they've brought to millions of their fellow countrymen in their 55 movie shorts and on the radio, Philco greets Tom Howard and George Shelton.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Taylor. That was very... Oh, how are you, George?
Hi,
I didn't... What brings you... How are you, George?
Oh, I'm all right.
Hope it's nothing trivial, George.
No,
you look all right.
Now, wait a minute, Tom. Wait, don't let's get all tangled up here.
Yeah.
How do you feel?
Now, wait a minute. Don't change the subject. That's none of your business. Look, I asked you...
What did you do? Get up with a grouch this morning?
No, she got up ahead of me. I know. She sleeps late.
Well, all right.
I'll
tell you right now, there's something the matter with you, Tom.
Well, there's nothing the matter with me. I feel fine, Mr. Sheldon.
Well, that's good.
Kept up. I had a nice dinner.
Ditto.
What did you say?
Ditto.
Yeah. That's what you said.
Yeah, you see, Tom, when I say ditto, it means the same.
What do you mean?
Ditto means likewise or the same.
What? Wait, now you mean you had the same thing for dinner as I did? Is that what it means?
Oh, no.
All right, what did you have? Go ahead, tell me why.
I don't know what you had for dinner. The thing is, you had.
Had the same. You
can't. Tom, stop talking for a minute, will you?
Well, go ahead.
Look, I'm trying to explain to you what ditto is.
Well, wait for a minute, George. Oh. Maybe I can help you.
All right, what you
is soup.
Oh, my God.
Maybe soup or
no.
Entree or something?
No. Tom.
Relish, maybe.
No, Tom.
Not relish.
Ditto.
I wonder how Paul Muni's operation made out.
Oh, never mind.
Okay, what is it?
Like it's ditto. It's nothing.
Oh, Tom. What is that?
Ditto is nothing.
Oh, it's nothing.
No.
Ditto. You mean you had nothing for dinner?
No.
Then how do you know I had a good dinner? What, are you on a diet?
No, what do you mean you had
nothing?
Wait a minute. Let me explain it this way.
Yeah, the other way was no good.
I say, Tom, have a drink.
Yeah, when did you ever say that? When did you ever say that?
Never mind it.
Now, wait a minute.
All right, you wait a minute. Now, here. Say we're in a restaurant.
Yeah, what do you want me to say that for? All right, I'll say it. We're in a restaurant.
All right. Now, the waiter says to me, what are you going to have?
Yeah.
And I say, bring me a glass of beer.
You order a glass of beer.
Yeah. Then the waiter says to you, what are you going to have?
Yeah.
And you say, ditto.
Yeah. Who says ditto?
You do.
Look, I'm not going to drink anything I don't know anything about. Now, wait a minute
here. But, Tom, you don't drink ditto.
Well, why can't I order a glass of beer like you do? Or milk or something.
No, Tom.
Tom. Beverage.
Ditto is not a drink.
Ditto? Then what is it?
It's nothing.
Oh, it's nothing. So you order a glass of beer and I order nothing, and that is. I thought it was funny you weren't going to buy me a drink.
Listen, Tom.
There I am sitting around while you're drinking the beer, looking at you.
Drooling
at the mouth.
Listen, Tom, when I order a glass of beer and you say ditto, the waiter brings you a glass of beer, too.
Oh, wait, you mean ditto is beer?
Yeah.
You mean when I go into a tap room and say, bring me ditto, I get a glass of beer?
Well, he wouldn't bring you the glass of beer unless I went in the place with you and ordered the beer first.
Now, wait a minute. You mean if I want a glass of beer, I got to hunt you up and take you out? Maybe you're out of town someplace.
Oh, listen.
Maybe you have a previous appointment.
All right.
I ain't going to look around.
How did we ever get into this? Look.
I don't know.
Here, I'll give you another idea.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Now, you're going to Atlantic City.
All right. Who's going to Atlantic City?
Well, I just want to say that to explain what ditto means.
You mean we got to go to Atlantic City to find out what ditto means?
There
must be a place closer.
Listen, Tom, I didn't say that.
Why should I go to Atlantic City?
Well, why does anyone go to Atlantic City?
I don't know. I don't go around asking people why they don't go to Atlantic City. None of my business. None of my business.
Will you shut up?
If people want to go to Atlantic City, why should I interfere?
Oh, no, Tom. Look, Tom, I'm only elucidating.
Well, I perspire myself sometimes.
Listen, Tom.
Yeah,
no, no.
Oh, you're mad.
No, no. When I say Atlantic City...
Well, I'm not going to Atlantic City or whatever
what?
The name
well,
is.
Listen,
my
you're not going.
Dropping
what? What?
Why can't we go to Detroit?
Detroit?
Yeah.
Well, what's the difference?
What? You don't know the difference between Atlantic City and Detroit? Atlantic City is
well,
a boring,
all right.
Boring place.
All right. Why do you want to go to Detroit?
I got friends there.
All right, friends. All right. We'll
my uncle,
there.
We could drop in and see
all
him.
All right, we'll go and drop in and see your uncle.
Okay.
All right. Now we'll make it Detroit.
Okay.
Now we both go down to the station.
Yeah.
I walk up to the ticket window and I say, give me a ticket for Detroit.
Yeah.
And you say, ditto.
I say ditto.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to Detroit, too. I thought I was.
You are going to Detroit.
I walk up to the window and say ditto, and the guy behind the ticket window hands me a glass of beer.
Oh,
yeah.
No. No. You buy a ticket.
I'm not going to buy a ticket for Detroit. I don't know anybody in Detroit.
Yeah, but Tom, ditto is Detroit. It's the same thing.
Ditto is Detroit?
Yeah.
Then if I'm buying an automobile, it'll be FOB ditto now.
Boy, I'm going nuts.
What, don't you like Detroit?
No. Huh? What, you should be on that program It Pays to Be Ignorant.
Well, I am on it.
You are? I thought so, because you certainly are a volcano of ignorance.
Well, what do you mean a volcano? How
what
did
I
we
said.
Get into that?
Oh, don't you know what a volcano is, Tom?
No,
well,
you can't even say it.
No, a volcano, Tom, is something that shoots off steam and fumes all over.
Oh, I married one, George.
Oh,
I married one.
Recent years have marked a rapid growth in the use of frozen foods and the importance of frozen storage in the home. Recognizing this modern trend, Philco was the first in the field of home refrigeration to introduce a complete line of refrigerators with a large, separate, completely enclosed compartment for frozen storage in addition to the regular ice cube chamber. In this compartment, there is ample space for keeping frozen food packages, meats, butter, and many other foods for long periods of time at below freezing temperatures. Remember, Philco introduced this novel feature before the war as an evidence of the progressive thinking and advanced design which it had brought to the field of refrigeration. Today, owners of these Philco refrigerators have good reason to congratulate themselves on their choice. For in these days of food rationing and restricted shopping trips, that frozen food compartment is rendering an indispensable wartime service which no other refrigerator owners can enjoy. Today, Philco refrigeration engineers are devoting their knowledge and ingenuity to the development of radar and electronic equipment. Tomorrow, they will bring you Philco refrigerators that express the newest ideas of modern science in food keeping and frozen storage, given new evidence of their leadership in engineering and advanced design.
I first heard Sophie Tucker in my college days when she was singing in Risen Weber's Mammoth Restaurant on Columbus Circle in New York. The food was all right, I guess, but that wasn't what brought me back night after night to Risen Weber's. It was Sophie Tucker. The last of the Red Hot Mamas, they call her. The last of a generation of great entertainers that included Eva Tangway, Blanche Ring, Nora Bays, and Irene Franklin. There's no point in explaining Sophie at this late date. For 35 years, she's been singing her songs in vaudeville and nightclubs on the air, wherever people gather to listen. As great a favorite in London as she is in New York. The Radio Hall of Fame takes this opportunity to bring you one of America's great entertainers, Sophie Tucker.
Thank you. Hello, Deans. Hello, Paul.
Hello, everybody. Paul, this is like old times, isn't it?
Sure is. What you going to give us, Tiny?
Well, Skinny, I thought I'd do a medley of songs I like best. After you've gone and left me cry. After you've gone, there's no denying, you'll feel blue, you'll
a time when you'll regret it. Oh, babe, think what you're doing. You know my love for you will drive me to ruin. After you've gone, after you've gone away.
By the wayside, it's the survival of the fittest. The big man squeezes the little man. That's called big business today. But when they're old and have hoarded their gold, that's when they begin to pray. They get religion, they give to charity to cover up their sins, I guess. But all the charity in the world can't hide their unhappiness. Now, I'm not a preacher, but I've been through the school. And any man who thinks the road to happiness is paved with money is just a plain darn fool.
So if you are really looking for the sunshine, look up, not down on the ground. Blue skies are up there, and you'll get your share, because there's plenty of around to go around. And you'll find that blue day all will be gone, gone, gone. Nothing but blue skies from now on. You'll miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You're gonna miss me, honey, when I'm far away. Then I feel so lonely. For you only. How's you know, honey? You've had your way. When you leave me, I know it's gonna grieve me. Gonna miss your big fat mom. You're a mama, I'm a big day.
And when you're gone, so far away, you'll be so good. I'm a big
next week, same time, same station, when the Folker Radio Hall of Fame returns with another show of shows. We'll expect you this time next week at the gate of the Radio Hall of Fame. Signed, Deems Taylor.
Next week, another brilliant gathering of stars with Connie Boswell, Benny Goodman, William Gargan, Mary Astor, Doc Rockwell, and others, as well as Paul Whiteman conducting the Radio Hall of Fame Orchestra and Chorus. This is Glenn Riggs saying goodbye for Philco dealers and distributors throughout the United States and Canada, and from Philco Corporation, makers today of radio and electronic materials to help win the war, makers tomorrow of materials for good living in a world at peace. The production staff of the Radio Hall of Fame includes D. Engelbach, producer-director, and Abel Green, editor of Variety.
Is the Blue Network.